Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in General History, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm one of the hosts on the channel, Dr. Amanda Melcher, and I am very excited today to be speaking to Mark Anderson about his book, Down the Warpath to the Cedars, Indians' First Battles in the Revolution, published by University of Oklahoma Press this year in 2022. In the book, Mark flips the usual perspective on this particular engagement in the American Revolutionary War and focuses on its Native participants, their motivations, battlefield conduct, and the event's impact in their world. In this way, the book does a lot of great work to establish and explain the role of Native Americans in the Northern aspect of the American Revolutionary War theater, and really provides the kind of first look, particularly from this perspective, of this part of Revolutionary War history. So I certainly learned a lot from this, and I think there's a lot to be brought into the literature from this work. So thank you, Mark Anderson, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for hosting me, Miranda.
So I wonder if you could start us off, please, by introducing yourself, your background, and explain how you came to write this book.
Oh, it would be my pleasure. I'm somebody who, like many people I'm sure you interview, has had a lifelong interest in history. When I finished my undergraduate studies, I went to become a United States Air Force officer instead of going into academia, but I always kept that passion for history. And then as time went on, I started looking into the possibility of doing research and writing to channel that passion. And really got into the publication, writing books by, as I was inspired by what was going on in the early 2000s, as far as American foreign policy went, with Afghanistan and Iraq trying to bring democracy to those countries. And it reminded me of this little episode that happened in the American Revolutionary War, where the rebel American colonists invaded Canada as an effort to bring them freedom and bring them into the United Colonies at that time that were in the Continental Congress. What was originally maybe an article interest became a book project as I saw that I wasn't really happy with the historiography that was out there. It was mostly dated, some detail and accuracy errors, and it didn't really look into the causes behind this American invasion of Canada and the Revolutionary War. And I focus on it as a war of liberation. So that went well. I was happy with what I produced with that. So I kept going. My second book, still staying in Canada and the American Revolution, focused on essentially a micro history, looking at two different people whose lives overlapped for a couple months during the American invasion of Canada. And then I was kind of thinking maybe I'd wrap up my research in Canada with a third book. And so I started off with the intent of writing a detailed battle history, kind of breaking it down to all the moving parts and what's going on. The Battle of the Cedars was one of the battles in the American invasion of Canada, and it seemed to have decent sources. And there were a couple controversial points about it. whether there was an Indian massacre that occurred there, and how responsible the American field commanders on the scene were for the shockingly bad performance of the American troops in this battle and their surrender. So I started off with that as my research project, but the questions that I started peeling back on led me to a much more expansive project, as you talked about in the introduction, looking at the Native American world. And it's much more than just a battle history. It's social, political, cultural exploration of the American Indian world before, during, after, with the Cedars as kind of a snapshot point to look at.
You'll not be surprised to hear that you are definitely not the first person who goes, so I thought this was going to be an article, and then it kept going. So that's a very common story and makes a lot of sense. There is quite a lot in this book. As you said, the sort of the battle in the title is almost a kind of framing point, but there's a lot of other things going on. And one of the things that's most interesting from a historiographical point of view is you show quite clearly how forgotten these particular events have become, that they're really not continued in the literature and the historiography, and particularly the military events, like what actually was the Battle of the Cedars. So given that that forms a really important basis for kind of our understanding of the wider sociopolitical things that you detail in the book, can you give us a brief overview of what actually happened in this instance before we move on?
Certainly. So time-wise, the American invasion of Canada happens very early in the Revolutionary War, within the first year before the what are then the United Colonies of English North America have even declared independence to become the United States. And there was this lingering question of Canada to the north, which had been New France, but conquered during the French and Indian War and was now part of the British Empire. Geographically, for those who aren't necessarily familiar with Canada or need a refresher of the historical time frame that we're talking about, at this point in 1775, 1776, the settled part of Canada is the province of Quebec on the St. Lawrence River, which runs southwest to northeast from the American Great Lakes out to the Atlantic Ocean. And then in the vicinity of Montreal, there's a river that goes off to the south, the Richelieu River, which connects to Lake Champlain, which with some portages connects to the Hudson River down in New York City. So there's a north-south corridor that links the New England and New York colonies with the province of Quebec. But it is not settled by the Euro-colonials really to any extent in that borderlands area between them. At the time of the Revolution, the St. Louis is a huge line of communication, transportation corridor, and the province of Quebec really has two major cities, Montreal in the southwest, where the Ottawa River and the St. Lawrence River meet. Montreal is actually on an island. And then on the northeast end of the province, there's the capital, provincial capital of Quebec City, which is really looking east to the Atlantic, where Montreal is looking west to the fur trade in the upcountry. So given that the province of Quebec is mostly French and Catholic, there's some questions about how they might be integrated in with what are otherwise English, mostly Protestant colonies to the south as this revolution is breaking out. So while what's going on in the 13 colonies is pretty complex between loyalists and the rebel patriots, it's even more complex in Canada as you have not only the French Catholics, but also Anglo-Protestant British settlers that have come in since the conquest. At the time I was just wrapping up my book, an interesting book came out on the American Civil War in the Southwest by Megan Nelson called The Three-Cornered War. And as I was looking at the Cedars, it's a lot more like an octagon or a decagon as far as all the different parties that are influencing what's going on in and around Canada, because not only do you have the rebels and the loyalists and the French Canadians and Anglo-Protestants, but you have all these Indian nations that are not homogenous or monolithic. They've got each got their own perspectives, and so they're influencing what's going on. Kind of taking a tangential step off of the main question. There's two major Indian confederations that are involved in the northern frontier borderlands area. Many of the listeners are probably familiar with the Iroquois, Haudenosaunee Six Nations at this time. They're in the region west of Lake Champlain out to the Great Lakes. From east to west, we've got the Mohawks, the Oneidas, the Tuscaroras, the Onondagas, the Cayugas, and the Senecas. Each of those will have different levels of play in what's going on. And they're pretty powerful. They're the confederation that both the British and the Americans are looking to influence the most. But there's a second confederation that was settled in the 1600s, early 1700s, along the St. Lawrence River by the French as mission villages. And each of these villages is anchored around Christianity, mission villages, and they're settled on strategic points coming into the St. Lawrence Valley. And those nations, by the time the British have conquered Canada, are identifying themselves as the Seven Nations. So they'll be the other big player in what's going on as far as Indian players go. And then there's this other tribe or nation in the Great Lakes area called the Mississaugas, who will play a smaller role as well. So jumping back to the question about the battle, really starts with the American decision to invade Canada. There's some concern about traditionally, whenever there's been colonial wars, attacks have come from Canada on the New England and New York frontiers. So they want to prevent that defensively. But as I said before, they're really also interested in bringing the Canadians into the Confederation or the Continental Congress to show North American unity against what they feel are British ministerial oppressions.
Lovely. Thank you for laying that out. We're going to get into, I think, some of the military details as we go on. But that's a really wonderful sort of scene setting for us. And I'm particularly intrigued by this idea of the sort of octagon of all the people getting involved, because that's quite apparent at the beginning of the book, just how many actors there are that are quite influential. And that there's not really a dominant, you know, there's a lot of things that are sort of up for grabs in terms of territory, in terms of economics, in terms of political influence. So kind of looking at both sides of this, starting off, why did both British and American rebel leaders want Native Americans to fight with them against the other? What was the motivation on the sort of colonial side for seeking out Native American allies?
For the British, who are really most interested, they had a very limited military force in North America, particularly in Canada at the time. And the Indians, Indian allies, were a way to offset that. The British were working against the time and distance of the Atlantic Ocean as far as getting reinforcements, where the Indians were already there at hand on what could be a vulnerable American colonial frontier. And the British had invested significantly in relationships, particularly, but also in resources. From the time of the French and Indian War up until just before the Revolutionary War, in the Northern, what they called the Northern Indian Department, Sir William Johnson was tremendously powerful. He was the British voice to the Indians, and he basically interpreted what was going on in the Indian world and communicated that back to England. And he was closely tied with the Mohawks in the Six Nations, and in fact had a Mohawk wife and several children that were part of the Mohawk Nation. So there was this close relationship with the Johnson family and the Indians, so that there was an expectation that these relationships and resources would come back in return as this war broke out. Sir William Johnson dies just before the American Revolution starts, however, and his nephew, Guy Johnson, inherits the role of superintendent. He's going to be a player in what goes on in and around the Cedars. There's a conflict of policy, however, between British leaders in North America, the governor in the province of Quebec, Guy Carleton, sees this Revolutionary War as a war for the American hearts and minds. And he thinks that if the Indians are, quote, unleashed on the colonials, that it's going to drive them away as opposed to bringing them back to the king. So he wants to use the Indians only as defensive allies, whereas Guy Johnson from the Johnson family is amongst those who really wants to seek a quick end of the war by releasing, quote, the Indians to unleash terror on the frontier settlements and essentially get an offensive victory through terror. So there's this tension within the British as far as that goes in bringing Native Americans along to fight with them. The other side of the story is the Americans at this point, as the war breaks out, really don't have the resources to be worrying about the Native American allies, and they certainly don't want Native American enemies. So they are actively seeking Indian neutrality. The concern is that if the war keeps going on, the Indians are probably going to get drawn in, and at some point they might decide that it's better to bring the Indians in as allies rather than have them choose to take the British side. But given the limitation of resources by the rebel Americans, they can barely keep a minimal amount of trade going, and certainly can't provide the wealth of gifts, trade goods, and perhaps money that is typically involved with bringing in Native Americans as allies. The Americans do achieve a particular diplomatic success right on the eve of the invasion of Canada. So the invasion of Canada happens in September 1775. At the end of August, they have a major conference in the city of Albany with the Six Nations, mostly arranged by the Oneidas, who are leaning more towards the Americans but are really strong neutrality advocates at this point. And so they secure a treaty for Six Nations neutrality that really frees them up to launch their invasion into Canada. And there's also pro-American element from some of these nations that is reaching out to the Americans, particularly from the Ganawaga Seven Nations nation that's near Montreal, who some of their ambassadors are actually encouraging an American invasion, promising support. Some of them even suggesting that Ganawaga warriors will join the Americans, even though they haven't really been solicited. So that's the picture. The British are more interested in bringing the Indians along as allies, where the Americans are more interested in just maintaining their neutrality because they can't afford to manage Indian allies at this point.
And what about on the Native American side? What sort of are the kind of considerations going on about joining up with the British or the Americans? And in fact, to spoiler alert for history that's already happened, Native Americans end up on both sides. So how does that kind of play out internally?
So obviously, as we've alluded to, there's many sides to this. We got nine Indian nations that we're talking about in two major confederacies. And then within each of these polities, there's many factions. The Native American political structure is directly influential on this. At village, tribe, nation level, they make decisions by consensus. There's not really coercive methods within their governmental structure, and their end goal is really internal harmony more than a foreign policy. So when no village or nation or confederacy makes a council decision on a specific action, then factions within that group are free to execute their own policy, whether it be diplomatic or military. And we see that from the very beginning of what develops into the Cedars, is that you got these different parties going off, engaging with the Americans or with the British. Used terminology of historians John Parmenter and Mark Robinson that have described this as active engagement or active neutrality. And that framework really helps explain what is otherwise an incomprehensibly scattershot Indian engagement that's going on there. Within the pro-British factions, I've already alluded to the Mohawk from the Six Nations that have these family links to the Johnson family. So at least that portion of the Mohawk Nation is very inclined to be pro-British. on the western side of the Six Nations, we've got the Onondagas, Cayugas, and Senecas, who, if you look at the map, they're very far west as far as trade goods coming from the Atlantic coast. They are very dependent on European trade goods coming down the St. Lawrence and into the Great Lakes to keep their 17th or 18th century economic trade going that they have become very comfortable with. And the Seneca Nation as well is considered the guardians of the western door of the Six Nations Confederacy. So they're very prone to going to war. So they are amongst the most receptive to British policy and see that perhaps as a way to fulfill their role within the Confederacy. In the Seven Nations, there's another village. I talked about Ganawaga, which is pro-American more. There's a second village, confusingly, called Kanesatake, which sounds kind of similar. It's west of Montreal, where the Ottawa River comes into the St. Lawrence Valley. And based on their position, a lot of their power comes from that trade coming in from the Ottawa River. So they're closely tied to whatever colonial power is ruling Montreal at the time. They were closely tied to the French before the British conquest, and now they're closely tied economically and militarily to the British. So as the American invasion of Canada plays out, you know, there's a fall campaign that goes on, and the Kanesatakes are the most dedicated British allies from the Seven Nations. So those are the key pro-British players. The pro-American side, the Oneidas, as I talked about, they helped arrange this Albany conference that secured Six Nations neutrality, and they're cooperating closely with the Americans. They have religious ties through a missionary, Samuel Kirkland, and that are essentially become, you know, expanded to become political ties to who have become the American rebels. And they're really strong advocates for neutrality. So there are a couple key points in the American invasion of Canada where Oneida diplomats go to talk to the Seven Nations and essentially secure their neutrality at critical points that help influence the campaign. While they're not really contributing any significant number of warriors to anything that's going on. And then the key players from the pro-American side from the Seven Nations are the Ganawaga Nation. And they're the council fire for this Seven Nations. So this is the political meeting place for the Confederacy. They have a history of being fiercely independent. Even the French didn't like how independent they considered themselves. And they're in the strategic position near the Richelieu River and St. Lawrence River intersection. And they've traditionally used that position to cross imperial lines and engage with New York, as well as the French who had been there before. So they get a lot of power by playing in that middle role and don't really want to see necessarily either side get wiped out, but definitely want to keep their ties with the Americans. And then there's this really interesting link that the Ganawagas have in that there's tradition amongst the Northern Native Nations that you can take captives in battle and you may adopt them. And once they become adopted, they are full-fledged members of the community. So several of the pro-American Ganawaga leaders were men that had been captured at various stages of their lives as children or as young adults in battles or raids, taken back to Ganawaga and adopted. And now they are amongst the most pro-American representatives of that nation. And then finally, the nation in the few years preceding the revolution started sending students to Dartmouth College, which was established as a school for training Indians, heavily Protestant religious emphasis. But the Ganawagas see that as a way to educate their youth and prepare them to be leaders in this modern, in their terms, world. So there's this close connection to Dartmouth as well that helps make them pro-American. So lots of players, lots of interest.
Thank you for explaining all of that. I think it makes it very clear to listeners when you talked earlier about the kind of octagon of lots of different players, like you weren't kidding. There's a lot going on here. And I think that's what makes it quite interesting, how in the book you play out these kinds of different interactions and show what was happening, that some of the kind of stock ideas we have about, oh, well, the British were good at this or powerful here or not, in this time period, there was actually a lot of kind of fluctuating uncertainty and a lot of instances where, at least from reading your book, it seemed like there were a number of negotiations where, of everyone who may have been in the room, it was the Native American politicians that sort of were the most informed and organized and had a goal. It didn't always seem to be the case on the American or British side necessarily.
Yes.
And even after kind of these decisions were made, right, the kind of the pitches were sent, you know, come fight with me, or actually, I think I'd rather throw my lot in with you. You know, there's all this sort of jockeying for alliance formation. Even after that, kind of some of those alliances were made, they didn't necessarily go so well, or they were kind of uneasy alliances. And I was wondering if you could sort of talk us through where some of those points of friction were, perhaps with reference to events on September 6th, 1775?
Yes. So that's a great example of where these relationships come under stress. The American invasion happened at the very beginning of September, 1775. The army, American army, initially lands on an island in the Richelieu River. And the first challenge to them getting any farther is a British post called Fort St. John's, just inside the Quebec border. So on September 6th, an American force tries to land and start to head towards this Fort St. John's, but they are met by an enemy force. The British in this fort send out 60 to 90 Indian allies and some British Indian Department officers to go meet this American advance. And I talked about how the British were sensitive of under Governor Guy Carleton's policy of trying to practice strategic restraint, only use them for the defensive. Well, now the Americans have come to them. They're ready to use their Indian allies. What happens is this engagement happens. The Indians inflict some losses on the Americans. The Americans inflict some losses on the Indians. But the Indians are particularly unhappy because once this battle starts, none of the British come out of the fort to help them. And they've only been given a very limited supply of ammunition. So they're not able to press any advantage and feel abandoned by the British. So they come back from this engagement on the 6th of September and express their displeasure to the British commander at the fort, and many of them depart at that point. Also, we'll probably talk to it in more detail later, but a good Indian war chief in their culture does not take losses. That's part of their war fighting culture is you don't achieve victory by taking losses. Losses are look bad on a war chief. So the Indian leaders in this battle don't come off looking good either. And then the Americans come 4 days later on a second attempt, and a similar battle happens. And in this case, the Indians take more losses and lose one of their French-Canadian interpreter friends. After this second battle on the 10th of September, almost all the Indians have left Fort St. John's. There's only a handful there from different groups. And as the fall campaign plays out, only the Seven Nations Gnesitagis, who I talked about before, that were particularly dedicated to the British, show up every time that Governor Carleton calls for allies. But then as they sit inactive, not being used a whole lot, they'll tend to filter back to their village until there's another call. And there's also this underlying concern about fighting other Indians that's playing on the Native American mind. There's a policy of tacit neutrality that's clear amongst most of the Northern Native nations that even though they will take different sides in these colonial wars, when it comes to fighting, they'll find ways to avoid actually fighting Indian on Indian, whether that's one side dropping out, both arranging to kind of disappear at the time of the battle, or shaping the battle so that this doesn't play out. So this is playing in the background as well. And the British talked about their concerns about Governor Guy Carleton's concerns about using them defensively. There's also this concern that they have limited control over Indian allies once they get in battle. The experiences of the French and Indian War, both with Indian allies to the British, but particularly with Indian allies to the French, brought out lessons that essentially your Indian allies are going to be likely to commit atrocities. And in part because of this tacit neutrality, they're pretty unreliable. They're not necessarily going to stick around and do all that the British might want from them. So there's this tension with the British and the Indians as well.
Thank you for explaining that. I'd like to get a little bit more into sort of Native American fighting culture and war. We've spoken about some of the key points, but could you maybe explain to us what parallel warfare was?
So parallel warfare was really laid out as a theory by Peter McLeod in talking about Native American relations with the European colonials in the French and Indian War. And really, in a nutshell, it is that Indians were allies in warfare, fighting for their own purposes by their own methods, and they're not just auxiliary forces to the European colonials. The British, French, English, North Americans, perhaps less so the Canadians, are fighting largely with European strategies for European objectives, using European operations and tactics, and what there is of the European laws of war at this point in time. Whereas Indians are coming in often with conglomerations of different Indian nations with varied strategies and objectives that don't necessarily align that well with what's going on with their colonial allies. And that when you get down to the role of an individual warrior, their objectives are particularly different from a Euro-colonial soldier's. The warrior is really looking for opportunities to demonstrate his bravery and fighting skill, building prestige back in his community. And the key method of doing that is through the physical spoils of war. From the least regarded to the highest regarded, we've got plunder. So any military goods, clothing, treasures that they might take from the enemy, to scalps, which are a measure that they've had some sort of battlefield conquest, to the most meaningful spoil of war is actually a live captive. Talked before about how some of these might be adopted, others might be kept in a sort of enslaved servant status, or there's always a possibility, and what bothered the American minds the most is potential of being ritually killed in Indian practices once you've been captured. So with these different ways of war, the Indians are casualty averse. They look to use mobile raids or ambushes. They're not really favoring any sort of siege warfare, and they travel logistically light. So when they are fighting, they're dependent on the British to keep them supplied. And they have a tendency to leave once their own objectives are met, or they see that opportunities for success have dwindled. Mm-hmm. So the British really dislike the realities of parallel war for all those reasons. There's a couple key points in the French and Indian War that I refer to within the book, at Fort William Henry and Fort Oswego, where the British and the French arrange surrenders, but then there's Indian massacres of the prisoners, British and American, that have surrendered. The degree of massacre in that is addressed in its own historiography, but that's definitely in the collective memory of both the British and the Americans. Yeah. As this is going on. So the British, understanding what they do of this parallel warfare, do feel some responsibility to try to limit the excesses of their allies once they've decided to bring them into the field.
Thank you for laying that out. Both it's interesting, obviously, in its own right, but also, as we will see, comes to play out a lot in kind of the events that you go on to chronicle. So before we sort of get into the aftermath or the contested bits, we've gotten chronologically to the initial American invasion of Canada, but the title of the book talks about the Cedars. So could you outline for us a little bit of kind of just the basic facts of the engagement at Fort Cedars?
Certainly. So taking a step back towards that fall campaign in 1775 with the American invasion, it initially has a lot of success. They take Fort Cedars, although it takes some time to do that. I mean, not Fort Cedars, Fort St. John's, which was the border fort. And from there, They move on Montreal. Governor Guy Carleton takes the last of his forces and evacuates to go to Quebec City because he really doesn't have the means to oppose the Americans anymore. So Montreal is surrendered to the Americans. They occupy that. And from there, they press on to pursue Guy Carleton up to Quebec City, establish a siege there. And things seem to be going pretty well until the very end of 1775, when the American forces try to take Quebec City and fail and are left with a very weak force. A lot of their troops have enlistments that expire at the end of the year. So there's this very weak American force in Canada that now is not in a great position and is looking for reinforcements to start coming from the American colonies. As this is going on in early 1776, Loyalist Canadians, British officers, and British Indian Department officials are working to try to play with this Indian diplomacy to bring in Indian allies to attack the Americans from the west as 1776 develops, while they also expect a British reinforcement force to come from the Atlantic into the St. Lawrence from the east and squeeze the Americans out from both sides. There was an entire British regiment that was stationed in the Great Lakes. The easternmost company of that was actually at a post on the St. Lawrence River called Fort Oswegatchie. And this really becomes the concentration point, the rallying point for these forces that start to gather to potentially attack the Americans from the west in the springtime. The Americans get warnings that this threat is developing, some more accurate than others. So as reinforcements start coming in, they send a lot of them up to Quebec City, but they funnel some of them off to establish a post west of Montreal at what will become Fort Cedars, that is about 30 miles ish west of Montreal. And these troops are taken from New Hampshire and Connecticut, New England troops that have just been formed to serve as reinforcements for what's going on in Canada. And they're put under the command of a veteran New Hampshire officer, Colonel Timothy Beadle. This Indian force assembles at Fort Oswegatchie on May 12th. We got about 40 British soldiers, 11 Canadian loyalists, and 160 Native warriors from mostly from the Six Nations, but also a significant Mississauga element. And they descend the St. Lawrence River in canoes and boats to head towards Montreal. On their way, they stop in the Seven Nations village of Akwesasne and pick up 50 more warriors. So the overwhelming majority of this force that's about to attack Fort Cedars is Native American. And then sort of describing the battle in a nutshell, the 18th of May, this force attacks Fort Cedars. After just a couple days of fighting, the Americans surrender. And there are almost 400 prisoners of war now in the British and Canadian hands. And then there's some other engagements that take place after that, but that gets us up to the point of Fort Cedars.
Wonderful. Thank you. So let's talk about that surrender, because you make the case quite convincingly, and you're not the only one. In fact, it was the case made at the time that the Americans should have held out longer than they actually did. So why was the fort surrendered, and what happened to the officers who were held responsible?
So talk about Colonel Timothy Beadle. He's in charge of this command at Fort Cedars. But he's also responsible for this whole region west of Montreal, which is many miles of river. And there's this key other responsibility he has, which is Indian diplomacy. He had served as the Americans' lead Indian diplomatic agent in the fall 1775 campaign. When he returns with these new troops in 1776, the regional commander, who is General Benedict Arnold, puts him essentially in charge of Indian diplomacy. And Colonel Beadle's problems really, besides the scope of his command, really start when he becomes inoculated for the smallpox. Smallpox is devastating the American army in Canada at this time. He's seen what smallpox can do during his French and Indian War service, so he makes the decision to get himself inoculated, even though he's going to take this command west of Montreal. So he's sick at the time that Fort Cedars is being built, and he's still sick just before the Battle of Fort Cedars when the Ganawaga Indians call him to a council in their village, which draws him away from Fort Cedars. The Ganawaga Indians were concerned about the collapse of the American army and wanted some comfort from Colonel Beadle, to get some confidence from him. So they'd called him there in part to talk about that. So Beadle is there when the actual scouts come to report that the enemy has been seen approaching Fort Cedars, long expected, but now they've finally been spotted. And these are actually Ganawaga Indian scouts. So Colonel Beadle has got a decision. Does he go back to Fort Cedars to help fight the battle, or does he go to Montreal to get more reinforcements to help fight the battle? And the Ganawaga Indians, by Colonel Beadle's account, convince him that he should go to Montreal. So he does that, gets reinforcements started, and then he starts to join them, but his bout with the smallpox is overwhelming, and he can't get more than a few miles out of Montreal before he just falls out and is essentially out of the battle. From there, he'll eventually be court-martialed for this, for not being at his post, and lose his commission. But he's allowed to return to the service the next year. And my take is essentially, they needed a scapegoat, somebody of his stature that would be held responsible. And the fact that he wasn't there was good enough reason, good enough justification to hang him as responsible for that. But what really the key player in this is his second in command, Major Isaac Butterfield, who has left at Fort Cedars. He's a man with few military qualifications, seemed to have been chosen for his role as much because he was a popular guy in his community, lived in a key point where he might be able to bring in recruits. So he's prepared for the demands and responsibility of battle. Interestingly, in the couple days before the attack happens, he seems to be actually pretty active in preparing for the attack. But once the reality of Indians outside his fort's walls appears, he seems to have frozen. So less than 2 days of fighting, he's taken minimal casualties. There's been no breach in the fortifications, which would traditionally be a point where you might consider a noble surrender. But the British have planted this seed in his mind by sending a couple flags of truce, trying to convince him to surrender, warning that the Indians will massacre the Americans if they don't surrender early and before the Indians have taken many losses. And so in the background of this, it's not explicit, but it's clear. Many accounts say that Butterfield was terrorized. And so the ghosts of Fort William Henry and these massacres that happened in the French and Indian War seem to be playing strongly on his decision-making. So he keeps junior officers from being too aggressive in their defense. And despite their protests, he decides to surrender on the second day, even though he's pretty confident that reinforcements are on the way. The only defense for his decision is possibly concern for the many smallpox suffering soldiers that he has under his command. They had been the first amongst those massacred in these French and Indian War massacres, and he has a good part of his force that is currently suffering from smallpox. But really, there's no military justification for what goes on. So there's this surrender that he arranges with the British commander, Captain George Forster, and they essentially agree to a peace on European terms. Guarantees to protect American lives. The British soldiers do their best to protect the Americans, but there is a lot of Indian looting, at least, that goes on once the surrender has happened.
So tell us about this. What happens after the surrender, and why do you say in the book that it, quote, underscored the essential differences between Euro-American and Native American concepts of war?
So the experience at Fort Cedars with the surrender between Butterfield and Forster looks a lot like the French and Indian War precedents at Fort William Henry and Fort Oswego and other forts where the Indian allies may be along, but the European colonials make a deal that shortcuts what the Indians might be looking for out of the battle. On May 20th, the day after Fort Cedars is surrendered, the reinforcements that Colonel Beadle had put in motion finally start advancing on the last leg to get to Fort Cedars, and they're about 4 miles out when they are ambushed by Indians and Canadians. So an American force under Major Henry Sherburne of about 100 men meets these Indians and Canadians. The Americans were unaware that Fort Cedars had surrendered. And so this battle breaks out. And where Fort Cedars was more like those other fort battles in the French and Indian War, this engagement, this ambush on the 20th of May, looks a lot more like another major milestone in the French and Indian War, the Battle of the Monongahela, Braddock's defeat, where the Indians ruled what's going on. There's no chance for the British and French or British and Americans to sideline what the Indians are going to do. So there's a short battle. The Americans stand, try to retreat, get cut off. They start running out of ammo. And so they attempt to surrender by throwing down their arms. But there are no surrender terms to protect the Americans once this is done. So the Indians follow their own customs. They're what are considered by the Americans to be atrocities. There's killing and scalping of wounded and dead. There's plundering of the surrendered soldiers, including stripping them essentially naked, probably just leaving them in their undergarments, and claiming of captives. So Indians are rushing to claim individual soldiers as their own captive. And once this initial battlefield chaos happens, they take these captives back to Fort Cedars, where they start to stew about the losses that they have taken in this ambush. They're really very small losses. They've lost one killed and two wounded Indians, but the one killed was a Seneca chief who apparently was highly respected. So the Indians start to prepare to ritually conduct revenge killings on some of the American officers in particular. So much like the Battle of Monongahela, you see how the Indians can take control of the battlefield after their victory. And really highlights that difference in the two different lines of parallel warfare. In this case, the British officers at Fort Cedars do appear to have intervened in time to prevent the killings by buying captives in some cases. They offer up an ox as an exchange for ritual killing, which had been done a few times in previous wars as a way to channel off that desire from the Indians. But in the chaos, many of the Americans were convinced that three or four of their compatriots had been killed. And Major Sherburne, who was the leader of this force that had been ambushed, came away convinced that one of his men had been killed by fire torture or roasted, in his word, although there never really doesn't appear to be any historical evidence to support that allegation.
Well, and what's really fascinating, obviously in the book, you get to go into more detail than answering my questions now. But what comes out really clearly with that detail that's really interesting is that it's not that the kind of the two key things are happening and get conflated, right? You've already outlined for us what parallel warfare is, what Native Americans wanted out of violence and kind of what the norms and cultural expectations were. And then, of course, we probably are more familiar with what the Euro-Americans would have expected out of something like this. And so this is a really good example of kind of these of norms clashing, of cultures clashing. And then most importantly, how the Euro-colonial interpretation of these actions kind of adds an extra layer to it. This idea of because the Americans could see some dead or wounded with their clothes stripped off, that immediately in their heads kind of jumped to this idea of torture, which from your examination of Native American war norms that we've already discussed, in fact, there is no real leap between those two things. And that kind of added an extra layer to this idea of a massacre that may or may not have been particularly related to actual facts on the ground. And you then trace this because it continues. It's not just about what happens in this day, in this place. In fact, it goes all the way back to the American Congress, who then later on take up this idea of the massacre at the Cedars by the Native Americans. And in fact, as you detail, come up with the Cedars resolutions. So can you kind of tell us about how this event sort of ends up in the kind of popular political imagination and sort of moves even further away from maybe the actual historical facts?
Yes. So there's definitely this collective memory expectation that once Indians enter the war, there's going to be things like the massacre that the Americans believe has happened at the Cedars. And so in Philadelphia, 500 miles away from what's going on at the Cedars, by early June 1776, the Continental Congress starts to get word that this battle has gone on. It's a shameful defeat. But then there's also these alleged atrocities. So the Congress forms a committee to investigate what's gone on. And this is 15th of June, before the Declaration of Independence has even been put out. And so Congress decides that they need to respond promptly to this first major use of British Indian allies and the somewhat expected atrocities that they believe have come out of it. So they investigate, gather reports from the commanders, and the Major Sherburne, who was led the ambush fight, he is sent to Philadelphia to provide testimony. And amongst the things he describes are this alleged roasting or fire torture of one of his soldiers that he didn't really see, but other soldiers saw. But the soldiers who told him about it were eventually taken away as captives by the Indians. So he doesn't have names, really, but he's pretty sure it's happened. So Congress really feels a need to act before the British try to sideline any British attempts to do something similar in the future. So they publish these resolutions on July 10th, 1776. So 6 days after the Declaration of Independence, they're publishing these resolutions that detail their version of what's gone on. There are a lot of errors in what they understand had happened. But the key point is they demand British accountability. They want the king to turn over Captain Forster, who has let these alleged atrocities happen. Wanted to deter continued use of Indian terror. And amongst the resolutions they make from their version of what's gone on, they say that the Congress says that they are not going to turn over British prisoners of war that had been nominally exchanged in a cartel to compensate for the Americans who were eventually released. So kind of taking a sideline here, the whole scene of the Cedars militarily ends where there's a showdown between Benedict Arnold leading a counterattack against the British and Indians that remain. The prisoners' lives, American prisoners' lives, are in great danger because the Indians are more likely to kill them than to let them be recovered. So Captain Forster and General Benedict Arnold reach a prisoner exchange cartel, the bottom line of which is the British and Indians will release their prisoners back to the Americans in exchange for an equal number of British soldiers to be returned later, because the Americans don't have that number of British prisoners of war on hand in Canada. So the resolutions make an argument that the British didn't fight honorably. If Governor or Captain Forster is not held responsible, then the Americans aren't going to meet their obligations by returning British prisoners. So that's the shocking element as far as the British and Canadian loyalists are concerned. Colonial newspaper accounts come out about what's gone on at the Cedars, and many of them publish these resolutions. So the Americans have a pretty consolidated account of what happened at the Cedars, even if it's not necessarily completely accurate. And that helps rally the American cause at this point, where they've just declared independence. Clearly portrays the king as villainous, somebody who would employ savage, quote, allies against the good American people. And the British and Canadian loyalists, once they start hearing of these resolutions and these accounts, act pretty quickly to rebut them. As one of my review readers pointed out, this seems to be a unique case where the British were pretty ahead of the game propaganda-wise. So they have a couple American officers as hostages. They get them to write letters saying that the British treated them as well as they possibly could have. They publish those. One of the British officers that's involved in at Fort Cedars publishes a detailed account that is really much more accurate than what the Continental Congress understands has gone on, and is really effective pro-ministry propaganda. But the Cedars remains this hot point in discussion until middle of the next year, 1777, when there's another campaign and invasion, British invasion from Canada with Indian allies that starts creating a lot more incidents, and those now have more resonance, and the Cedars kind of falls to the back as far as points of contention go. But the issue of the prisoner of war cartel lingers for the most of the war, with the British still demanding every time they talk about prisoner exchanges that, you know, this part of the ledger needs to be settled. And eventually it's kind of quietly written off.
So what then do you think we can learn from this piece of history that is often forgotten? How does it deepen our understanding of the Revolutionary War?
I think it clearly demonstrates the importance of Native Americans in shaping the Revolutionary War, even before it started. There were political diplomatic efforts going on before the first shots had been exchanged in the Revolutionary War. And then there are political, military interventions, and in some cases, military absences directly steered the flow of military operations in Canada and the New York, New England borderlands in this critical first year of the Revolutionary War. By looking at the Indian battles in Canada in the fall of 1775 and at the Cedars as the first Indian battles of the Revolutionary War, it really gives us different perspectives from the traditional historiography, which is focused on battles that happened later in 1776 down in Carolinas and Virginia against the Cherokees, or even look at 1777 campaigns as the first real Indian battles. By moving that timeline to the left, we get different perspective on the Indians' goals, motivations, particularly with regard to the Seven Nations and the Six Nations concerns with the St. Lawrence trade. And the deep dive that the Cedars provides really shows the complexity of this Indian factional act of neutrality that was almost completely indecipherable for decision makers at the time, including those who were, you know, the most expert on Indian diplomacy, and thus have been very difficult for historians to interpret in the meantime, and really serves as a correction to binary or monolithic interpretations of the Indians were on the British side or the Indians were on the American side. No, it's more complex than that. And this concept of active neutrality really helps explain what's going on, why there's different groups from different nations engaging both sides.
And also how sort of decisions, those kinds of decisions were reached. I think one really helpful detail was just the idea of, if there wasn't a confederation level decision, that opened up agency for individual or smaller level communities to kind of make their own decisions. That's a really helpful thing to know in order to kind of make sense of actions that otherwise might seem contradictory. In that framework, actually, they make a ton of sense. So the book does kind of have a lot of useful correctives. But I wanted to also ask a bit about the kind of behind the scenes aspect of the process of creating the book. I'm wondering if you could speak to us a little bit about kind of your methods for this and sort of how you got all this information and put it together. And in particular, if there's anything you came across in the process that was surprising to you.
So I'm a rabbit hole historian, like I'm sure many of us are, where every time I see an interesting topic, I dig deep on it until I get to the point where I go, wait a minute, this isn't going to contribute to what I'm doing. So run down a lot of leads. There are understandably very few Native American voices captured in primary source documents. So I had to do a lot of reading of British and American documents kind of from across the grain, different filter, what they were saying. And one of the most interesting I found there was the British Indian agent, John Butler, had a journal where he doesn't say what the Indians were expressing, but you see his pattern of speeches as he goes on and what points he keeps coming back to really highlight, presumably, what the natives' points of interest were. So that was one document. But the thing that really surprised me the most as I dug into this was the Ganawaga pro-American faction's influence and contributions to what went on in this broader scheme around the Cedars. With their factional outreach and encouragement to the Americans, they made repeated promises to provide hundreds of warriors to help the Americans, even before the Quebec defeat. So even before the Americans really needed help, they're making these offers. And some of these offers are coming from the group that is not necessarily all that pro-American. So you see the pro-American faction's influence internally as well as externally. And came across this little-known treaty that the Ganawaga signed with the Americans in January 1776 in Albany that promised neutrality and made no obligations on the Ganawagas, which is interesting because all these other American treaties with Native groups in the early, well, throughout the war, tend to put some obligation on the Native group. And this one, the Ganawagas essentially promised not to attack the Americans, and that's the end of their responsibilities. And then a couple key documents that I came across in my rabbit hole searches. One was one of the Ganawaga pro-Americans, a central character throughout my book, is a Ganawaga Mohawk named Louis Cook, more commonly, or as I refer to him, Louis Adiatahorongwan, which is his Mohawk name. There's actually one document where he probably is telling somebody else, but it's his voice, of what all he is doing in this 1775 to 1776 period, which is greatly enlightening, connected a lot of dots that otherwise wouldn't have been connected. And I came across some payrolls and accounts showing that Colonel Timothy Beadle had enlisted a company of 26 Ganawaga scouts under Louis Adiatahorongwan, which explains their role in being the first scouts to report that the British and the enemy Indians were approaching Fort Cedars. And really, I don't think anybody else had come across that. And the Ganawagas apparently contributed hundreds of warriors at the time when the Americans were pursuing the British and Indians back after Fort Cedars. And played a key role in Council of Seven Nations neutrality as the American effort in Canada had just completely gone to pot, and the best they can hope for is to withdraw. The Ganawagas helped secure this Seven Nations neutrality that allows the Americans to evacuate without Indian warriors providing any great influence on what's going on.
Brilliant. Thank you. It's always great. I'm sure you have this as well when you're kind of up to your ears and hunting something down in a rabbit hole, and then you find the document that kind of clarifies things or gives you a new lead. It's a very satisfying feeling. So thank you for sharing that with us. And this book is just out, so it does feel a little mean to ask. But now that the book is done, what are you working on now or next?
So I think I might finally have found my exit out of Canada without getting too far off of topics I've looked at before. So I'm exploring the different Indian nations, tribes that allied themselves with the Americans in the Revolutionary War. I've got three anchor points right now: the Oneidas, the Stockbridge, and the Catawbas, who are down in the Carolinas. As I'm initially casting my net out, looking for other groups that may have tied their fates more with the Americans, and looking really to compare and contrast their motivations and contributions to the American side of the Revolutionary War, where Indians have typically been looked at as being British allies. Mm. Kind of doing the initial secondary source research, looking forward to a point where I can be confident that COVID might not interfere with my archival research before I start heading off on vacations. But that's where I'm looking to go next.
Cool. Well, best of luck with that research, both in terms of finding what you want and in terms of being able to actually travel to the archives. But in the meantime, listeners can read your current book, again titled Down the Warpath to the Cedars, Indians' First Battles in the Revolution, published by University of Oklahoma Press in 2022. Mark Anderson, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, Miranda, for your wonderful interview.